Off top, apparently it's been discovered that goldenback frogs in India are capable of growing bonnet mushrooms out of their side. At least one of them did. Bonnet mushrooms normally feed on decaying wood. Play the music!
This is the Dominique Foxworth Show.
Welcome to the Dominique Foxworth Show. Megan sent me that. It was a weird article. Anyway, it was kind of cool. It's like they normally, but anyway, I liked it. I enjoyed it. My weekend was fun. Your weekend was, I don't know, who cares? I gave a really awesome speech that motivated the leaders of tomorrow. I'm fantastic. It was fun. The theme of my speech was to be cocky, which is consistent with my true personality. It was a good speech.
I thought you were going to say your weekend was fun. You had a bunch of mushrooms.
I did not have any bonnet mushrooms or any other hallucinogenics this weekend.
Cremini?
What's cremini?
It's just a regular mushroom.
Oh, I don't know anything about mushrooms.
Shiitakes?
I do know about those. Portobello.
Good.
Mushroom trivia out here. All right, so we got a fun new game that we are going to unveil today. I can't wait to play. Charlie, you want to explain the rules?
This game is called The Headline, The Take, The Reality. I will give you guys some headlines that are floating around the ether, the sort of hot take that's on the periphery, and then Dominique's going to give us the reality.
Ooh.
The first one, we're going to start with the NFL, and then we're going to transition into the basketball world. The first one, the headline at the NFL Combine, wide receivers are really, really fast. This came off of Xavier Worthy, who
Lord
ran the 4.21.
Before we get any further, 4.21? That's all. That's all. I just wanted to say it again. I saw it. It's crazy. Mm-hmm. Like, we are getting close to 4.19 territory, which is absurd. But anyway, I saw that number, and I was like, and I got excited.
Yeah.
I got excited for him, just like I got excited for John Ross, just like I get excited when anybody runs a crazy fast time. But please continue.
It's crazy. And obviously, he's a receiver at around 160 pounds who normally wouldn't have a traditional wide receiver role in the NFL. That's changed over time. Guys like Tank Dell, et cetera, et cetera. Other receivers ran fast. You have guys like Adonai Mitchell, who is now seen as a first-round pick by running in the 4.3s. Ladd McConkey, not sneaky athletic, just actually athletic. Same measurables as Garrett Wilson, who's skyrocketing into the first round. The question about it is, if you look at the 20 fastest 40-yard dash times ever for wide receivers, these are guys who end up flying up draft boards but don't have careers that match. Only one of them has a 1,000-yard season. That's Santana Moss. So here's the take. You should evaluate the tape and not jump receivers up way out of their draft range simply because of a 40-yard dash.
All right. So, I mean, I think that's obvious. Yeah, that's right. But can you actually execute on that? Because it's so damn exciting. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned, I don't think that I traditionally have fallen into this trap, but I did fall into this trap because I do think that when the film matches, they have great route running ability. And that's why I brought up the name John Ross, because I remember getting really excited for John Ross before I saw his 40 and was like, all right, this guy is good. He's a good route runner. Like, I liked him as a receiver. And then he ran that crazy 40 time and I almost passed out and was like, maybe he is going to be the greatest receiver ever. And I think that's part of the problem is those numbers don't matter as much. And we've kind of historically known that. I'm not sure that I know the Seahawks kind of made a living out of like focusing on specific numbers and that it does. There's like a bar that you need to be over. But I think the higher you are, you clear that bar, it does not mean you're going to be any better. And I think that's the scary part, is you need to look at the film and not get caught up in this, which is obvious, right?
Yeah. Well, so what I think is interesting about this is the NFL for a long time had prototypes at these positions that were toolsy, and it was big, strong, fast. And now, because of the amount of space that's on a football field, these prototypes are sort of changing, and you're trying to find players that can do unique gadget things in space, and that opens up the world for Xavier Worthies, where you're like, could this be a Tyreek Hill type player when those are like anomaly one-off players? And I wonder if we need to find new prototypes for certain skill groups of receivers, and you break them down differently. Like, you're looking for guys like, I mean, the most productive receiver, rookie receiver of all time was Puka Nacua, who got drafted because he ran a 4.6, but he's just a big physical guy who has an amazing knack for getting open and then being tough after the catch. And I think there'll be more subcategories moving forward in evaluating receivers. And ironically, like, I don't think it's just receiver that this toolsy stuff is really affecting. It's you're seeing it with smaller edge players as well. Like, one of the stories of the combine going into it was there's not a true number one edge in this draft like there has been in the past. Then you see Dallas Turner run a 4.46, Chop Robinson go from a fringe first round pick to a top 15 guy for running a 4.48. And his time in the 10-yard split was around 1.5 seconds. That comps to other 6'3", 240-pound edges. Vernon Golston, Barkevious Mingo, Nolan Smith. And those are guys who have been regretful decisions, but who knows now, because the way the positions are being used is changing.
It sparks a bunch of different thoughts in my mind. And I would say, like, there's two things that's happening at the combine. There is draft evaluation, and then there's entertainment. Mm-hmm. And that's always something that's happened in football, but it's never bled into the draft process before, because that's normally something that's behind closed doors. Like, the recruiting and the evaluating draft process has never been considered entertainment. It's now become entertainment. And aside from that, it's not just that it's become entertainment. We've put such a high premium on those numbers in the draft class, or excuse me, the GMs and the scouts have also, that the players train for it.
Yeah.
So when the combine was originally, like, thought up, it was because we didn't have the internet, guys. We didn't have film everywhere. It was like, let's see if this guy actually is real. Let's get him here. This is going to be the first time we actually lay eyes on these guys, and they weren't training for it. So what I imagine the combine could have been helpful for, it's like, all right, what's this guy really about? Throw him out there. Let's see him do some drills. Let's meet him. Let's talk to him. Let's introduce ourselves. And guys weren't training for it. So I do think that there's something to be said for the draft, the combine, the physical things on the combine are not a representation of the player you're getting as much as they're a representation of the player times how good his training was, which, I mean, you're never going to, as someone who prepared for the draft and balled out, I killed the draft numbers. Like, I never did any of that ever again.
It's so funny, too, because Marvin Harrison Jr. literally just was like, nah, I'm good.
Of course.
You've seen how fast I am, how big I am, and my tape, and you know my name. It's Marvin Harrison Jr. Caleb Williams was like, we're good. Drake May, we're good. You can measure me. The rest of it, we're good.
Yeah, and I think that maybe we'll go in this direction, but it's an interesting thing for a league that's always trying to make more and more money, and I know there are some topics later where that comes into play. This has been a cool little unexpected entertainment property they could sell and make money off of. But as these players start to recognize, and particularly the top players that are most interesting, recognize that you can't do anything but hurt yourself. Yeah. There,
well,
you know?
Unless you run a 4.22.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Because, yeah, it's weird because we have the evidence that the big numbers do not translate to on-field production, but that doesn't translate into the draft-making decisions. They still get excited about these big numbers.
And some people do. Like, obviously, like we talked about this before, Aaron Donald skyrocketed off draft boards because of his measurables and his combine stuff. And people are like, oh, but he's smaller, but...
Sorry to cut you off, but that's... I do think that it has some value to some people, but those are people who are, like, in the back, in the mid. Yeah. Those are not people who are getting people to turn on the TV to watch him. So, like, it may have some value for them, but not anyone else. And I also saw this thing with Odunze out there. He's going to stay like that.
How much did you hate that?
I hated it
so
much.
How much did you hate that?
I hated it so much. So for those who don't know, he's a receiver out of Washington, one of the best in the draft.
Yeah, awesome receiver.
Yeah, and he was doing the three-cone drill, and I guess maybe he had practiced and got a 6.6, and he refused to go off the field until he was able to execute the 6.6 time during the actual combine, and he kept knocking over the cone. He kept doing it over and over again, and I'm thinking, for who, for what? Why are you doing this? And then no one else is out there. He's just out there running it by himself. And then there are people like who are like fawning over, like, yeah, he's stick to it. He's a tough guy. He's never going to give up. It's like, all right, I guess in neither way, like there's two ways to look at it. Like he's just doing this nonsense in order to like get attention. That doesn't give you a thumbs up. I assume that's not true. And then the other one is like, he's actually like, no, I got to get this. But that seems like short-sighted.
The tin cup moment.
Yeah.
I mean, that's... Rome Odunze got a little bit too close to high knees down the aisle on an airplane. I'm going to tell you that. From my taste, a little too close.
It wasn't even that. So, like, there's that. That's what I was saying. That's the first possibility that is, like, performative.
He cares a lot.
Yeah. And I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt and say that's not it. The second possibility is that he was serious about this.
Yeah.
And to me, there are some people who are like, that's good. But to me, that shows, like, a misunderstanding of the assignment. Like, you're not, this is not what we're here to do. Like, you've shown what you could do. And to me, that just made no sense and seemed like a waste of everybody's time and effort.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Was there anything that you did going into the combine that you were like, this is actually a representation of my athleticism of why I'm good at football? Because I remember when Byron Jones set the world record for the broad jump, there was actual, like, scouts were talking about being like, that's a representation of his explosiveness from being flat-footed. This is real for him being a Swiss Army knife DB.
I think all of it is.
Okay.
But I think that more than anything, it's a bar that you have to clear. You know, so I think the difference is there are people who are super athletes, but the difference between great players and, I was going to say good players, but great players, great NFL players and bad NFL players is so small. Like, the difference in them is so small. And I think it comes into play with, like, a lot more mental stuff than it does the physical stuff. And as long as you're not terrible, yeah. And I do think that they're different style of players. So back to your point about prototypes. Yeah. That you get a better idea of what this guy is good at and how he can be used. DBs, you kind of have to be versatile. Mm-hmm. But offensive guys, you can kind of put them in position to do the same thing. And sometimes for defensive guys, too. But you find out what this player is good at and where you're going to, like, how you're going to use them. And I think that some of that stuff is nice to give you an idea. But you know what's better? Watching them play football.
Yeah.
And the only reason why the combine could help you is you're like, all right, maybe he was injured a lot in college, or his coaches were terrible, or whatever system he was in didn't help him, or the teammates around him were so bad you couldn't see that he was great. And the reason why his film is so bad is because he was failed by everybody else. Yep. And there's a diamond in the rough.
This is the last thing I'll ask. Is speed sort of like arm strength for quarterbacks? It's something we discussed ahead of time where you need a baseline, you need to be able to make all the throws. You can't be out there. I guess that's not fair. Jake Bobo's out there running a 5-second 40.
Yeah, but I mean, Jake Bobo is an absurd anomaly.
Yeah. Anything over the top is sort of a party trick if you can't execute in small spaces and get open or make contested catches.
I think that's a good way to think about it, but I also don't think that it's absolutely true because I think that there is, like, some version of arm strength that is like, oh, and we've seen it with we see it with in some version of accuracy. Like, I would say that for any of these, like, measurable skills. We saw Drew Brees have an incredible career because he was so precise in his placement. And you see the same thing with Josh Allen with his arm strength. And I think the same thing is true of speed for certain positions. But a lot of times, some of the best guys, because I was thinking about this, when you give me those 20 players who, except for Santana Moss, were disappointments, essentially, who ran the fastest 40 times of all time.
Yeah.
They're
the official electronic combine ones, because this takes out some of the apocryphals, the Joey Galloway 419, the Bo Jackson 412.
Right. Didn't Dion, it was like, believe that Dion ran 4.1?
Backpedaled to 4.5 and then left in the limo.
Yeah, but I think that to the point that we made about Marvin Harrison, there are a lot of guys who didn't run at the combine and only run at their pro day who are really fast and been fine. It's like Randy Moss comes to my mind as like, I bet if Randy Moss trained for the damn combine, he could have gave you a 4.2 if he wanted to. And so I think that the top 20 is a little misleading, but I think the major walkaway, which should be obvious, is watch the damn tape.
Yeah.
And we can get excited for the combine because I watched that Xavier Worthy 40 so many times this weekend. It was so fun every time I watched it. I loved it.
Can I tell you something?
What's that?
I love fast guys and big arms. I love it. Oh,
your man Milton.
That video of him throwing the 74-yard pass and then hitting it with the finger gun midair. Honestly, a team should draft him just for like 3rd and 20s to arm punt at 70 yards. Because you're going to get some greedy DB who's going to catch it on their 4-yard line.
Every greedy DB. Yep. Oh, yeah. You get an interception? Don't nobody go back to see how
punt
you got
God.
Him.
Punt God.
You think so? You could run him in for a play and then run the ball. Because and hand it off. Because if you put
5 wide.
Oh, if you put him in, they're putting in extra safeties and everybody's getting depth.
This is like the idea of drafting a 7-footer just to block field goals. He's a Hail Mary specialist.
Oh, they got to expand the rosters.
Bazooka Joe. Great nickname.
My gosh, it is.
Can I tell you one combine fact that I heard from the Ringer Fantasy Football Show? Now they're running Ringer Draft Show during the draft process. Apparently there were like smaller NFL organized pro days, but this was before like scouting was as high budget. So they just combined it, and it was initially the combine, and then we've just affectation over time made it the combine, but we're just mispronouncing it.
That's a good off top. They should have gave that to me. I wonder if since we're saying ridiculous things, I wonder if somebody, we make fun of the Cincinnati Bengals for having one of the smallest scouting departments and being cheap. Like, I kind of feel like with everybody doing all this work, you could have one dude with a fast internet connection and like perform the draft almost as well as any other team.
Just read Nate Tice and you'll be fine.
Daniel Jeremiah and Tice. You may not. And there are like so many people who put in effort to like tell you what your team should do. Like, I mean, you wouldn't be embarrassed. You think that if we had one team that only had one guy and a laptop, if we would be able to select that team, like, oh, you know who the idiot is? You know, would we be able to select the team who had the single guy running the draft? Because I know we would have last year, we'd have been like, hey, it's got to be the Lions. The Lions are definitely the one draft room guy.
Or the Belichick Cole Strange picks when he has 50 guys on. He only has a 50-person draft board. And it's like, that guy's gone. I got to take Cole Strange or got to trade down. I mean, I guess Cole Strange has been good. That's a bad example. But still, the idea, he was they thought he was going to be a third-round pick. He went in the first round. I do wonder why you know, like auto-drafting in fantasy football?
Yeah.
When you're just like, I'm going to take the guy at the ADP. If someone just like auto-drafted based on like an aggregate of all the analysts' predictions for people, they'd do pretty good.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that it'd work out just fine. And if
Washington auto-drafted, we would be a better franchise.
Oh my gosh. Did we just get everybody in NFL fired? Except for like the general managers?
Pretty much. So, all
right, sorry, guys.
Speaking of someone who is going to potentially get, actually, you can't because Stephen Jones is the GM, getting someone fired. There's Dak Prescott news. Here's the headline. Jerry Jones has suggested that Dak Prescott could play next year without a contract extension. He has a unique contract where he cannot be franchise tagged. He could have free agency. Dak finished second in the MVP. He's someone who has earned a big contract. Here's the take. Dak Prescott, from his own person, shouldn't want a contract extension. He should want to hit free agency so he can get the fully guaranteed contract a la Kirk Cousins, because that's how you do it. That's how you maximize leverage.
So, first of all, Jerry Jones's words hold very little weight at this point. Like, he says so many things. So, I wish that I felt, like, moved by the things that he says, but I don't. As for the Dak thing, this is becomes a more, like, core question, because you're saying like maximize his payment. Yeah, I think in order to make as much money as possible, then yeah, he forces them to play this year with him on that number so he can get to true free agency. He has a no franchise and a no trade clause, so it's right now up to him whether he signs an extension that reduces his cap number and keeps him in Dallas long term, or he plays out this year and gets to true free agency. The only way that I think that that is an actual smart decision is if he's already got him and his agent have already designed a landing spot and that's the place that he wants
Miami.
To be. Maybe, whatever. If he's figured it out and that's what he wants to, and that's where he wants to go, and he feels like that's the best chance for him to have success. Because I don't think at this point that there's any better place to be than be a really good quarterback for the Dallas Cowboys for your entire career. It's a pain in the ass. Like, and I feel like calling it a pain in the ass is an understatement for how, and I know everyone's saying he makes so much money, it's fine, but these are two separate things. How much money you make and like how it feels to be like.
You're talking to producer Brian.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Obviously. But I think that it's obvious that someone who's talked about struggles mental health and has lost his mother and his brother, that it's how his quality of life matters more, I would think, than additional $10 million where you already have hundreds of millions of dollars.
I mean, that'd be my thought also. But, I mean, okay, let's talk about this from the like the football perspective too, because he's played on a lot of really good rosters.
Yeah.
For like a lot of his career, like you can say what you want about the Cowboys. They've gotten over the hump. It's going to be hard to maintain that roster with the $60 million cap hit this year. He's now being judged. Like we don't really remember that hot stretch he had during the regular season compared to getting – because they got embarrassed by the Packers in the playoffs. And that's like an indelible image on an otherwise great season, because that's the level he raised the team to at certain points. He's in certain ways in a damned if you do, damned if you don't, because he takes a big guaranteed contract. So you know more about how they would structure it. Maybe they'd be able to get it. But like CeeDee Lamb's going to come after the Jefferson extension. That's going to be a huge deal. He's a notch below Jefferson or Tyreek Hill's or wide receiver, even though he's the number one. Dak is a notch below Josh Allen and Patrick Mahomes, and I guess Josh Allen's a notch below Patrick Mahomes. You get my idea. Yeah. And it's you start hamstringing your team to be a team of very good. And I know the options are be a team of very good or start over and be a team of very bad. And that's not a fun world to live in.
That's a very good way of framing it. And I would say that when teams get to or win the Super Bowl,
yeah,
we call them great.
Yeah.
A lot of those teams are very good. And so, like, if you're a very good team, you have a chance. Most teams in the NFL are not great. And we can look at last year's Super Bowl champion. That was not a great team.
Yeah.
They had a great player and a great defense. So my point is, are you going to blow up a team that has a legitimate Super Bowl chance because you cannot build a team that's like a guaranteed Super Bowl contender? That to me seems absurd. Well,
what if Dak wants to blow up that team and go somewhere else? Because
I'm talking from his perspective too.
Well, I'm saying, like, at a certain point, if you're talking about mental health and him having already made close to $500 million after the time of his next contract, you think he could just cherry pick a new situation where he wants to go?
Absolutely. The problem with that is you have to then go, well, actually, you may not, but it's about winning championships.
Yeah.
Like, that's the only thing that his career is about at this point, or at least getting to a Super Bowl. He's done enough. I mean, he hasn't won MVP.
A great run.
Yeah.
He needs to have at least because, you know, Burrow's kicked back the timeline by having a great run, and Josh Allen at the 13-second game.
You get to this point, and we've talked about this a bunch of times, where the reward for reaching a new milestone when you're like a superstar as far as fame is concerned is that you then are measured against an even higher bar.
Yeah.
And for Dak Prescott, until he at least gets to a Super Bowl, I think it's going to be like hell for him, which freaking sucks. But I don't know that. The problem is he multiplies it if he goes somewhere else.
Yeah.
It's like you left this team and now you really, but it doesn't necessarily get better because they blame him for everything in Dallas. And then when they inevitably, which all teams do, are going to have to move on from some good players, they're not going to blame anyone but Dak Prescott and his contract, which is not true or fair. It's a way to do things.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you enter the Kirk Cousins world. I'm not like, actually, not him as a player.
Right. No, I know what you're saying, where it's like he's gotten paid a lot of money, so people believe that it makes the contracts harder to build around. And I, as I've always said, like, yes, it does make the job of the GM a lot easier. But, I mean, it's your damn job. Find us some discounts.
Yeah.
Like, coach around the shortcomings that we have. I'm doing my job. You do yours.
I kind of want to see Trey Lance playing a game next season. Not about that.
Yeah, just, I know.
That leads into
why?
I want to see it. It's like, what's it going to look like?
Not good.
But that leads into our next topic.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured. It was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Barnstown, Kentucky. 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely. Swimsuit, check. Sunscreen, check. Phone charger, check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or in a carry-on. And the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Tired of ads interrupting your favorite sports podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music, included with your Prime membership. Amazon Music offers the most ad-free top podcasts. Enjoy shows like First Take, Pardon the Interruption, and The Low Post, available ad-free and uninterrupted. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or go to amazon.com/ESPN Pods. That's amazon.com/ESPN Pods to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is ESPN's Mike Greenberg, and ESPN Bet is ready to take you through all the biggest sports moments this spring. The official sports book of ESPN has exclusive offers and markets from Scott Van Pelt, Stephen A. Smith, and me. From the playoff intensity to finally getting out to the ballpark, there's no better time for sports fans. Sign up today, and new users get $100 in bonus bets for making any sportsbook bet. Download ESPN Bet today. What a play.
Must be 21 plus and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply. See app for details.
Okay.
Which is, here's the headline. The NFL wants to add an 18th regular season game. They want to one day have 20 regular season games. There are caveats in this that players other than quarterbacks can only play 17 of those 18 games. Yada, yada, yada. Here's the take. The NFL is looking at this as an entertainment product to make more money. This does not make it a better entertainment product. We already are struggling with week 18 as it is. This is going to, sure, I'll watch. I'm not going to lie and say I'm not going to watch.
Yeah.
I'll watch every second of it on Red Zone. We'll sit outside our studio and talk about that game. It does not make it better. We just had a season with it, with an elongated regular season where we lost Justin Herbert. We lost Aaron Rodgers. We lost Joe Burrow. And what do we know about football? The more you play, the more chances you get hurt. The more of quarterbacks that get hurt, the worse the game is.
You did the take and the response. Because, and I'm shocked because
I got excited.
No, it's fine. I appreciate it. I'm not mad at you because I can build on that. I'm shocked because you are the demographic that I would expect to be excited about adding another week. And this is like the thing that I was going to ask you that I wasn't sure what the answer is, because of course we can talk about the health and safety stuff. Like, we still don't have a complete grasp on what the head traumas do to people. So adding another game seems irresponsible because of that. But we don't have to have that unfun conversation. We can put it out of our minds as we always do when we watch football. That's fine. We can talk about this other stuff.
We'll CT it for now. We'll just
push it back. So is there just completely elastic demand for football would have been my question for you. And it seems like the answer is obviously no, because all the other major sports leagues in our country have obviously feels like gone too far with products that they're selling to us.
So I don't think there's an elastic demand for games that matter. The question is and by the way, I should clarify, we wanted to get to 20 games without preseason. Whether you say it's more or less football, a lot of these stars don't even play the preseason.
It's obviously
games.
More football.
Yeah. But worth clarifying. The question is when's it become something where it's clinched, guys are resting, guys aren't trying hard, you're stacking for competition, you're trying to play different seeds, et cetera, et cetera. I know that's never been a football thing in the past, but there will be a tipping point when that becomes something.
Let me ask you this question, because I think that's obvious. And if the 18-game or potential 20-game schedule precipitates that, then I think obviously that's a problem for the entertainment value that you're going to receive. But the question is there, if we had 52 weeks of high level football, would we stop watching at any point?
No, I'd watch every second of it.
That's sick. I don't believe that. I can't accept that. That's not real. It's no way. Because the fact of the matter is,
what else would you do on Sunday?
No, I'm not saying
I don't have children.
I'm not saying that we wouldn't watch. I'm saying that the numbers that football enjoys will absolutely go down. Like, it's basic supply and demand. There's one principle that I think is probably fairly true.
I don't know.
I guess if you're selling crack to crackheads, then I guess there is no supply. That's too much.
Literally, Roger Goodell sitting in a kitchen right now yelling, cooking. I'm cooking some up.
Oh, shout out to Joey.
Snowy Joey, legend. So let's pivot to the NBA for a second.
Oh, yes. They don't have too many games.
LeBron James.
He's never played too many games.
At compiler.
That's the dumbest shit I've ever heard in my life.
LeBron James. We have a lot of headlines about LeBron. LeBron scored his 40,000th point. There was a LeBron-centric comment that Bronny James, who's averaging 5 points a game at USC, will base his decision to go pro or not based on team interest, which seems leading to where LeBron will say will sign, or if he can convince a team to draft his son. And then the third part, which was leaked to Windhorse, that LeBron is looking for a 3-year, 9-figure deal from the Lakers. That would be around $160 million over 3 years, take him through age 42 and 24 NBA seasons, which would be the most of all time. I think the Bronny stuff is the most interesting thing.
Yeah.
And to me, the take is a team shouldn't do this. A team shouldn't even feign interest to get LeBron and just draft his son.
We're already in an ugly place.
Yeah.
Because if what you're already saying is that the only reason why anyone would draft Bronny is like a favor to LeBron.
Right now, and, certainly.
Yeah, and in hopes to get LeBron to come there, or I don't know, what else, just to appease LeBron generally.
I don't know.
Yeah, some sort of attention. I don't think that's good for a player who doesn't appear to be ready. And I don't think that's good for whatever image we have of LeBron or the NBA. I think we already have enough like jokes surrounding Thanasis and Antetokounmpo.
Chris Smith, JR's brother, who the Knicks signed, who couldn't play in the league.
And it's not an unheard of thing that you bring in somebody on the roster that's like maybe a fringe player or maybe wouldn't have made it even on a 2-day or a 10-day because it's to appease some star. But when it's as high profile a star as LeBron and his son Bronny, I don't know that there's any benefit really to gain from it unless he turns into something, which puts a lot more pressure on him.
It's also like, of course, Bronny's lifestyle is not comparable to what I'm about to say. His life is going to be well-funded and good regardless of what happens. But there was a book called Boys Among Men about the high school to NBA jump that came out a few years ago, and it documented the amount of failures and what it did to people's psyche because you basically get forced into like this highly competitive thing that you're not nearly good enough to at a really young age, and you're looking at it because of bad intel as like this is your opportunity to do it. To me, it seems crazy to force that on someone who has way more options like Bronny. Like this isn't the type of thing where it's like go to the NBA now or you might not get to do this again and you're not going to make money. I'm sure he's making a great amount of NIL money, not that he even has any financial concerns, and he's just not even ready to really play Pac-12 basketball at a high level.
I mean, that's honestly, that's an interesting thought for LeBron or for Bronny, well, LeBron Jr., because it's a situation that so few people are in, especially so few people at that age, where you could do anything except the one thing that it appears that you really want to do.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's not to say that he can never grow into an NBA player. He might at some point, but it doesn't. I mean, no draft analyst seems to think that he is there yet. But I mean, he has all the options in the world.
It's also just like if he gets drafted now, it's going to feel so inorganic. It's going to feel like, oh, we just decided to draft Bronny because we liked his tape at USC. We're going to hope LeBron signs here. And like,
As someone as media savvy as LeBron's been in his entire career has to understand that. And so like, I can't imagine that because the running joke for the past several years has been someone's going to sign, going to draft Bronny because it believes that they can get LeBron.
Yeah.
So one, I know what you're going to say, that you don't want LeBron at this age, at this number. But two, they know that that's like, I can't imagine that Bronny wants that. I don't know. He seems like a really talented, proud young man. He doesn't want for this nonsense storyline to actually happen and be stuck to him. It's like, oh, I'm only in the NBA because my daddy made it happen.
I mean, the LeBron aspect of it is actually interesting because paying that amount of money for someone who's going to be that age, it's like it's unprecedented. And he is not impacting winning the way he used to in his prime. And I think that's just objective, even though the numbers are ridiculous. I think there are going to be some teams who are actually like, we're good on that.
Yeah.
Not every team. I'm sure some team would want to do it. But
out of 30 teams, I think there are plenty of teams that will be happy to have LeBron at any number for any amount of time. But those are not teams that I think are serious championship contenders. If he wants to ride on some championship buses, then he's not going to be a max player, right? Like that's in his future going forward.
Yeah, that's right. Last one.
All right.
Here's the story. This might be the biggest story outside of the perpetual love of football in this country going on right now. This is Caitlin Clark broke Pistol Pete's Division I scoring record. There are caveats with that people have been very defensive over. I mean, Pistol Pete played without a three-point line. He played 3 years, et cetera, et cetera. What Caitlin Clark has done is transformed women's college basketball into like must see. There are 10 million people who watch the national championship compared to 728,000 who watched the final game of the WNBA finals. She also declared for the WNBA draft. Here's the take. Caitlin Clark's a transformative figure for the WNBA.
I'm not sure that I agree. And I know the numbers that you're going to cite about how popular Caitlin Clark is. But I think it's possible that she could be because the NBA, and I think more players other than Caitlin Clark deserve credit. Like college basketball, women's college basketball has been on the rise pre-Caitlin Clark. Like I think about the Big Arike shot that everyone's excited about. Like there have been lots of big games and big moments that have lifted this this player to a position where that she can then take it to an even higher level. And like, yes, she might be the most popular women's basketball player ever right now. It doesn't mean she's the best, but she's certainly the most popular. My issue is I'm not sure that the WNBA is in position, if she gets there, to elevate it. Because she needs reasons for us to watch. She needs to give us a reason to watch. Yeah. And while you walk around and I see a lot more Iowa sweatshirts in the streets than I ever had before, I think it is directly connected to Caitlin Clark.
Yeah.
And girls in Iowa jerseys, like, it's obviously directly connected to Caitlin Clark. When you go to these little basketball tournaments, there are lots of girls there who are obviously influenced by Caitlin Clark. However, I don't believe that we're about to see a bunch of Indiana Fever shirts in the streets, because people don't like aren't locked into that. And I think by give them a reason to watch, I think her debut, people will watch. But she needs a giant to take down. She needs a reason for us to tune in. And I think watching her play is going to be cool. But I'm not sure that without the bird to her magic, or I guess maybe magic to her bird, without that.
LeBron to her Curry.
Yeah, without that, then what are we, unless she's going after something, like she's trying to break the single season scoring record, a single season wins record. These are things that give us the reason to watch just regular season WNBA games.
So I think that her debut, as you mentioned, I think will likely be the highest rated WNBA TV product that's ever happened. I think that the sideshow things of her shooting at Steph at the All-Star game and Sabrina Ionescu will be hugely interesting, because of, I mean, you could do who can shoot from further with her and Steph Curry.
Yeah, be fun.
Where I sort of disagree is, like, I don't think it's like, I don't think that this is sort of like a match with a wick where you just light it and it's on. With these, with the, like, a league that transforms, like, yeah, Bird and Magic transformed the NBA, but it was really like a 12-year crawl from Bird and Magic to Michael Jordan to the Dream Team to the 90s NBA, where these guys became massive worldwide stars, to the Euros, et cetera, that's happening now. I think whether or not Caitlin Clark is as good as, and obviously I didn't watch Cheryl Miller play basketball, right. I'm not going to pretend to be like the biggest expert on Diana Taurasi, who people say is the best player ever in the WNBA. The odds are she will not be as good as Diana Taurasi. The interesting thing is she is the most visually appealing and creative women's basketball player I've ever seen. She's doing stuff that dudes, arrogant dudes who think that they could, you know, there's the amount of dudes who think that they could beat Serena Williams in a tennis match. They watch Caitlin Clark do stuff and they're like, that's impossible. And that to me is like the first step of like changing the way the WNBA is perceived.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fair point, because there's always something to be said for watching the game played in a way, or played similar to the top level, but being obvious that it's not the top level.
NBA players won't take these shots.
Yeah, I get it. And seeing her do that does matter. But the point that you're making seems like it's just agreeing with me.
Yeah,
is that
more or
like,
less.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that Caitlin Clark's success is because of a lot of women and girls before her. And she happened to be that spark at the right time to help lift women's college basketball. And if you are, and I think you made a really good point about the actual history of the NBA, and this is true about all stories, is we then like boil them down to these simple plot points. And the way, even though I wasn't there for it, the Bird and Magic stuff, like I remember it is like, oh, they had this great college finals game. And then they showed up to the NBA and everybody became NBA fans. And what you're saying is, which is probably closer to truth, is that it took some time and then they handed it off to Michael. And now we look back at that moment as something special. So I think that goes back to my original point, is Caitlin's going to need some more people.
I'm wondering what the social media impact will be, too. It's like if she has games where she scores like 48 points and it's 13 threes in the WNBA game and they're like from the parking lot, how viral those clips are going to be and how that, because I can't remember a truly viral WNBA clip. I really can't. And maybe that's, I'm just revealing my inherent misogyny on this. But I can't remember a player this fun. I can't remember the most fun college basketball player being a women's player.
Yeah, she's obviously the most fun college basketball player. Maybe I go to this hobby horse too much, but like the conflict of business and competitiveness in sports is interesting to me. And you making the point that her having these like signature moments and having these marquee games where if she scores 45 points or something,
yeah,
that's going to get on TV and that's going to get a lot of people attention. That's going to get people to watch again later. And we've talked about this before with like rule changes in basketball and rule changes in football to make the games more appealing. I just wonder if they recognize, obviously they recognize that she is a potential transformative figure coming into their league, like how the rest of the league, if they acknowledge that the profitability and future well-being of this league could be riding on this one person having a historic career, how does that influence the rest of the league's behavior?
That's a really interesting, it's a golden opportunity for WNBA right now. And it's really interesting because like there are a lot of people are saying, interesting, she's leaving Iowa because the stage is bigger for her there. So if the WNBA doesn't capitalize, that's not ideal.
It's a sentence I've never heard in my life about anyone, that their stage is bigger in Iowa. I mean, except
shout
for
out
like
Lucy.
Presidential elections, the only time anyone pays attention to Iowa. Caitlin Clark shooting in primaries.
Yeah.
Or caucuses, I guess. Yeah. That was fun.
That's great.
Yeah. Shout out to you for doing an awesome job on today's show. Thanks to Pawville, because this is great. Also, Megan gave me that frog fact. Appreciate her making it easy for me. Thanks, Megan, Serafina, Brian, Kevin, and Tez. We out.
This is the Dominique Foxworth Show.